Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive.
Great to be back.
Today, we're going to be looking at Kurdish life, specifically those historical differences between communities in the mountains of Kurdistan and those living down in the plains and lowlands.
Yeah, it's a fascinating contrast. Our main source here is a report. It's called Kurdish Mountain versus Plains Life, Environmental Determinants and Cultural Adaptations.
Okay.
And it pulls together quite a bit of information describing traditional Kurdish ways of life, you know, before all the major modern disruptions really changed things.
So the idea is to understand how these really different environments, the rugged mountains, compared to the, well, more open plains, how they might have shaped everything from making a living to social structures, politics, even cultural expression.
Exactly. How did the land itself influence life?
Okay, let's start with the basics then, the geography. Set the scene for us.
Well, Kurdistan, fundamentally, it's an upland region dominated by these two huge mountain ranges, the Zagros and the Taurus. And this area forms the traditional Kurdish homeland, stretching across parts of modern Turkey, Iraq, Iran, Syria, and even a bit of Armenia.
And the Zagros Mountains, they run sort of northwest to southeast, through western Iran and northeastern Iraq.
That's the line. And they're known for these parallel ridges with deep valleys in between. Historically, they acted as a real buffer zone.
A natural barrier.
Precisely. We're talking about areas like Iran's Kurdistan province and the mountainous parts of northern and northeastern Iraqi Kurdistan. That ruggedness, that inaccessibility, that wasn't just a physical barrier. It kind of fostered a certain independence.
Made it hard for outside powers to control things.
Definitely. Allowed communities to maybe evade direct imperial control for long periods, developing their own ways of governing, often based more on kinship than, say, some centralized authority. You could argue that echoes even today.
Interesting. And the other range, the Taurus.
Right. The Taurus Mountains, they dominate southeastern Anatolia, so Turkey, and they push down into northern Syria as well. Also very rugged, also a historical place of refuge.
And the report mentions some ancient groups linked to these areas.
Yeah, it mentions the Gudi and the Kardachoy. Ancient peoples who lived in these uplands, and some scholars think their names might even be connected to the origins of the name Kurd. It's a long history in those mountains.
Okay, so mountains dominate, but what about the other areas? The plains.
Adjacent to the mountains, you have plains, plateaus, fertile valleys. Think northern Mesopotamia, what's often called Upper Mesopotamia or Al Jazeera in Iraq and Syria.
Right.
Plus the foothills of the Anatolian Plateau and these really rich river valleys created by tributaries of the Tigris and Euphrates.
Like the greater and lesser Zab.
Exactly. The Zabs, the Diyala, Kabur, Gamasya, Korasu rivers. And Al Jazeera is notable. It's an alluvial plain, historically great for farming and trade.
So a real patchwork of landscapes. Climate must have been different, too.
Oh, significantly. Mountains are generally colder, wetter. You get forests, oak, beech, sycamore, fruit trees like walnut, fig, almond.
Sounds quite lush in parts.
It can be.
Yeah.
Whereas the plains are typically hotter, drier, more steppe-like vegetation, grasses. Trees like plane, willow, poplar tend to cluster along the rivers and streams.
Okay, that makes sense. And accessibility, you touched on that. That must be a key difference.
Huge difference. Mountains mean refuge, difficulty for outsiders. Plains mean easier movement, more connectivity for trade, sure. But also more exposure to armies, empires, state control.
And resources would differ too, naturally.
Absolutely. Mountains offered those crucial summer pastures for herders, timber, specific crops you could grow in valleys or on terraces.
Like fruits and nuts?
Yeah, that kind of thing. The plains, though, offered extensive arable land, perfect for grains like wheat and barley, and cash crops like cotton. And we can't forget the mineral resources, especially oil.
Right, places like Kirkuk, Konakin in Iraq, Batman in Turkey.
Batman, Silvan, Rumilan in Syria too. That oil has obviously become massively important in modern times, politically and economically.
But the report stresses this isn't just simple environment dictates everything, right? It wasn't deterministic.
Exactly. That's a key point. It's not like the environment just forced people into one way of life.
Yeah.
People adapt. They innovate.
How so?
Well, you see terraced farming carved into mountainsides that's shaping the environment. You find Kurds living across all these terrains historically, not just confined to one. And crucially, the whole system of nomadic pastoralism that actively used both the mountains and the plains. It bridged the two.
Okay, that's a great bridge to the next point. How did people actually live? Traditional livelihoods, economic adaptations. Let's start in the mountains.
In the mountains, the dominant way of life traditionally was pastoralism, herding sheep and goats primarily.
Nomads.
Often, yes, or semi-nomadic. The defining feature was transhumance. That's the seasonal migration.
Moving the herds.
Exactly. They'd move between the Yalaw or Zozan, the summer pastures high up in the mountains, and the Geshlag or Garmian, the winter pastures down in the lower valleys or plains.
Following the grass, essentially.
Pretty much. Agriculture in the mountains was important, but often supplementary. Done in fertile valleys, on those terraces we mentioned. Mostly growing food for themselves. Cereals, fruits, vegetables.
Any cash crops.
Tobacco was grown as a cash crop in some foothill areas, yeah. Plus, they'd use forest resources, and crafts based on wool and leather from their herds were vital weaving. For instance, there's incredibly ancient roots there.
Okay, and life down on the plains, how did that differ?
Down on the plains, settled agriculture was much more central to the economy. Wheat and barley were staples. Cotton was a major crop, especially on the Anatolian plains.
Did they have different farming techniques? More irrigation, maybe?
Potentially, yes. The report mentions the possibility of more sophisticated techniques like crop rotation and irrigation would have been crucial in those drier areas. Mm. You might see things like Quinault systems, those underground water channels or diverting river water.
And being on the plains, closer to cities and routes, more trade?
Definitely. Their location put them right along trade routes and near major urban centers, Mosul, Diyarbakir, Erbil, Kermanshah. These were hubs for administration and markets. So plains communities were generally more plugged into wider commercial networks. Al Jazeera, again, was historically known for this.
So different focus, pastoralism versus agriculture, but you said they were connected.
Absolutely connected. Historically, there was a really crucial interdependence, and pastoral nomadism was the link.
How did that work?
The plains provided essential winter grazing for the mountain herds, plus markets to sell animals or buy goods. The mountains offered the vital summer pastures and also acted as a refuge in times of trouble.
A symbiotic relationship.
Exactly. The pastoral economy really needed access to both zones to be viable. It's fascinating. There's even a 10th century Arab geographer, Ibn Hakal, who actually mapped out what he called the summer and winter resorts of the Kurds.
Wow. So it was a well-established pattern.
Very much so. And it wasn't always a rigid divide either. You had semi-nomadism within the mountains, too, people moving shorter distances. And families or tribes might shift between more settled farming and pastoralism, depending on conditions.
And you mentioned nomadism wasn't just economic.
Right. It was also, you could say, a socio-political strategy. It maximized resource use across different environments, sure. But being mobile, especially in rugged mountain terrain, also made it much harder for centralized states' empires to tax you, conscript you, or generally control you.
A form of independence, almost.
In a way, yes. Which naturally leads us into thinking about social structures and political organization. Let's stick with the mountains first.
Okay. What characterized mountain societies?
The fragmented landscape, the difficult terrain, it really encouraged decentralized structures. Society was often organized around kinship, clans, local chiefs, agas.
Less top-down control.
Much less. The geography allowed lots of local power centers to emerge and persist. This is where you see the rise of these autonomous or semi-autonomous Kurdish principalities, emirates, chiefdoms.
Like the ones mentioned in the report, Botan, Hakkari.
Exactly. Botan, Hakkari, Bodanan, Soran, Baban, Bukri, Ardalan. Many of these survived well into the 19th century. And even before that, in the medieval period, you had Kurdish dynasties like the Shaddadids, Rawadids, Marwanids, Hasanwehides, often rooted in these mountain strongholds.
So the mountains were a cradle for Kurdish political entities.
They really were. A physical and political refuge. It allowed for resistance against successive empires, right back to the Assyrians, through the Ottoman and Persian periods. It fostered this strong sense of local independence. Even when nominally part of a larger empire, these mountain heartlands often ran their own affairs to a significant degree.
But did that fragmentation have a downside for, say, wider Kurdish unity?
That's a really important point the report touches on, yes. While it fostered local autonomy, the tribal structure and the geographical divisions often worked against broader political unification. Rivalries between different principalities or tribes were common.
And we still see echoes of that sometimes.
You could argue that some modern political splits have roots in those historical divisions, yeah. It's complex.
Okay, so what about the plains communities? How did their situation differ socially and politically?
Well, because they were more accessible, plains communities generally had much more direct, sustained contact with centralized states.
More exposed.
More exposed to imperial administration, taxation, military drafts, even pressures to assimilate culturally or linguistically. Less of that natural buffer the mountains provided.
Did the focus on settled agriculture change the social dynamics too?
It likely did. Settled farming communities might have developed social structures less focused on, say, large kinship networks for defense, or the kind of military readiness that was often necessary for mobile pastoral groups in the mountains. Maybe different priorities emerged.
And the cities, you mentioned Mosul, Erbil, Diyarbakir.
Right, the influence of those urban centers on the plains and foothills was significant. They were melting pots, centers of trade, administration, learning. They acted as intermediaries between the rural communities and the wider empires, shaping relationships in a different way than happened in the more isolated mountain zones.
So there's this constant back and forth, this interplay between mountain autonomy and the influence of lowland powers.
Exactly. The mountains often served as the base, the refuge, where Kurdish political structures could endure or reemerge. Mountain Kurds were frequently the core of resistance movements. But the resources and population centers of the plains also drew Kurds into the orbit of larger states. Think of Saladin and the Ayyubids, or the significant roles Kurdish groups played along the Ottoman-Persian frontier regions.
And even modern movements reflect this somehow.
You could see it that way. Modern autonomy movements, like the Kurdistan Regional Government in Iraq or the administration in northeast Syria, they draw on that historical legacy of mountain-based self-rule. But they also have to engage politically and economically with the central states, often based in the plains. It's a continuation of that dynamic in a way.
This really paints a picture of how geography wasn't just a backdrop, but an active force. Okay, let's shift to culture. How did these differences show up in cultural expressions, identity, language, maybe?
Okay, language. Kurdish, or Kurdish. It's part of the West Iranian branch of Indo-European languages. So it's related to Persian and Pashto, but it's definitely distinct from Arabic or Turkish, its neighbors.
And it's not just one single language, right? It's dialects.
Exactly. It's really a collection of related dialects, often grouped into major branches. The two biggest are Kurmanji, or Northern Kurdish.
That's the most widely spoken one.
Yes. Spoken across large parts of Turkey, Syria, northern Iraq, generally north of the Greater Zab River, and by diaspora communities. Then there's Sorani, or Central Kurdish, mainly in Iraqi Kurdistan south of the Greater Zab and in parts of western Iran. It tends to have maybe more affinities with other Iranian languages. And then you have Southern Kurdish, sometimes called Pehlavani, further south in Iran and Iraq, plus numerous sub-dialects within each of these.
Is there a neat geographical split, mountains versus plains, for dialects?
It's not that simple, unfortunately.
Right.
While Kurmanji is dominant in many northern, often more mountainous areas, the actual distribution is really complex. It's been shaped by historical political units, those old principalities we mentioned.
Ah, so their boundaries might match dialect boundaries.
Sometimes more closely than modern state borders do, yeah.
Yeah.
Migration patterns play a huge role, and of course the drawing of modern state borders has influenced things too. But using those old emirates as a lens can be quite revealing. And you also have Kurdish communities far away, like in Khorasan in Iran or the Caucasus, which shows it's about more than just the immediate Kurdistan geography.
Okay, so language is complex. What about religion? Mostly Muslim, right?
The majority are Sunni Muslims, yes. Predominantly following the Shafi school of law, though the Hanafi school is also significant, especially in some areas. And Sufism, mystical Islam, has historically been very strong, with orders like the Naqshbandi and Qadiriyya having deep roots.
But there's a lot more diversity than just Sunni Islam, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely. Significant diversity. You have Shia Muslims, especially the Faili Kurds, found near the Iran-Iraq border, and historically in Baghdad, with origins often linked to Luristan.
Okay.
Then there's Alevism, practiced by a substantial number of Kurds, particularly in Turkey, often seen as a more heterodox tradition.
And Yazidism?
Yazidism, yes. A very ancient indigenous faith, often described as syncretic. Its traditional heartland is around the Sinjar Mountains in northwestern Iraq, but Yazidis also live in Syria, Turkey, and the Caucasus.
Yersinism.
Yersinism, also known as Ali Haq or Kakai, found mainly in the Kermanshah province of Iran and some parts of Iraq. Again, a distinct faith tradition. And historically, you also had small communities of Kurdish Jews and Christians, plus the historical backdrop of Zoroastrianism in the wider region.
So, a real mosaic. Does religious conservatism line up with the mountain plain divide? Are mountain communities generally more conservative?
Not necessarily, no. It seems much more tied to other factors.
Yeah.
Urban versus rural settings make a difference. Regional traditions are important. Which specific denomination we're talking about matters a lot. And state policies have also influenced religious practice.
So it's complicated.
Very. you might find perceptions, say, of parts of Iraqi Kurdistan or southeastern Turkey being more traditionally conservative, often linked to Sunni Islam and strong tribal structures. But then you might find urban areas in Iranian Kurdistan are influenced by broader Iranian social trends. Alevi Kurds are generally considered less conservative. It really varies place by place, group by group. You can't just draw a simple mountain plain line for religious practice.
Oh, Hannah the Chai Lady is here. Rojbosh Hannah.
Ah, brilliant. Rojbosh. Perfect timing.
Let's see. Sipping? This is good today. Nice and strong, not too sweet. How's yours?
Sipping. Mine's lovely, too. Just right. Not bitter at all today. Next. Needed this.
Me, too. Okay, everyone. We're just going to take a moment to enjoy our chai, and we'll be right back to continue our discussion. Short pause.
And we're back. Okay, before the chai arrived, we were talking culture, language, religion. What about material culture? Things like clothing, houses, crafts. Did they differ much between mountain and plain?
The report suggests they likely did, reflecting those different environments and lifestyles we discussed. Think about clothing. It probably varied depending on the climate, whether you were farming or herding.
Heavier wool in the mountains, maybe?
Quite possibly, yeah. Housing materials, too. You might expect more stone construction in the mountains where timber and stone are available, maybe more mud brick used in the plains. The sources don't go into huge detail here specifically for Kurds, but it's a reasonable inference.
And crafts reflecting resources. Exactly. More wool and leather crafts tied to pastoralism in the mountains, perhaps different kinds of crafts linked to agriculture or trade in the plains.
But even with these regional variations, there were strong unifying cultural threads.
Absolutely. Big ones. The New Year celebration around the spring equinox is huge. It's celebrated by Kurds across all regions, regardless of dialect or religious background. It carries deep meaning about renewal, resistance, cultural identity.
A shared touchstone.
Definitely. And you have shared folklore, epic poems, music traditions, dances, a collective sense of history, even with all the internal diversity. These things weave Kurdish culture together across the different landscapes.
And speaking of unifying symbols, the mountains themselves, they seem to have a special significance beyond just being a place to live.
They absolutely do. Profound symbolic importance. The mountains are seen as the Kurdish heartland, the ultimate refuge, a symbol of resilience, freedom, endurance.
There's that famous saying, isn't there?
Kurds have no friends but the mountains. Kurdistan siye nebinhe vale meninin. It captures that feeling perfectly.
Where does that deep symbolism come from?
It's forged in history. For thousands of years, those mountains were the sanctuary. From Xenophon's Greeks struggling against the Kardachoi to tribes resisting the early Arab conquest, right through centuries of dealing with Ottoman and Persian empires, the mountains were where Kurdish communities could often maintain some autonomy, resist assimilation, survive.
It's based on real lived experience over centuries.
Exactly. Ancient records mention mountain tribes. Classical sources describe them. There's this long, long association, and that symbolism endures powerfully today, even for Kurds who live in cities or plains or in the diaspora far away. It's a unifying image that evokes shared stories of struggle, autonomy, perseverance. It's fundamental to understanding Kurdish identity and aspirations.
Okay, let's bring this towards the modern era. The 20th century brought massive, often traumatic changes that kind of cut across these older distinctions, didn't it?
Profound changes, yes. The collapse of the Ottoman Empire after World War I, and the subsequent treaties Sevres initially, which proposed a Kurdish state, but then, crucially, Lausanne in 1923.
Which didn't.
Instead, it finalized the partition of the Kurdish inhabited lands among the new nation states. Turkey, Iraq, Syria, and Iran.
And the consequences of that partition were huge.
Devastating. It fragmented a previously more interconnected region. It cut across traditional migration routes for nomads, separated families and tribes, disrupted long-standing economic and social patterns. It was a fundamental rupture.
And the new states weren't exactly welcoming to Kurdish identity.
No. Generally, they pursued policies aimed at assimilation or suppression. In Turkey, you have the denial of Kurdish identity, the Mountain Turk theory, language bans, brutal suppression of uprisings. In Iraq, the Ba'ath Ath regime's Arabization policies, culminating in the Anfal campaign.
Horrific.
Truly horrific. In Syria, many Kurds faced statelessness and discrimination. In Iran, periods of cultural expression alternating with suppression and conflict. It created a shared experience of statelessness and struggle.
And all this led to massive displacement.
Yes. forced sedentarization policies aimed at controlling nomads, deliberate village destruction, especially in mountain areas during counterinsurgency campaigns by various states. This all resulted in huge numbers of Kurds being displaced. Many moved or were forced to move into large cities.
Cities like Diyarbakir, Erbil, Süleymaniye.
Diyarbakir, Van, Mersin in Turkey, Erbil, Süleymaniye, Kirkuk in Iraq, Kermanshah, Sanandaj in Iran. These cities grew rapidly, creating new urban Kurdish societies, but often severing ties with traditional rural life, whether mountain or plain.
So looking at today, how relevant is that old mountain versus plain distinction? Are the socioeconomic differences still tied to that geography?
It's really complex now. That historical legacy is there, but it's often overshadowed by modern political realities. Yes, some remote mountainous regions might still face greater economic challenges, less infrastructure, fewer job opportunities outside traditional sectors. Rural areas, including mountains, might retain more traditional social customs, for better or worse.
But the plains weren't necessarily easier.
Not at all. Plains areas, especially resource-rich ones like Kirkuk, became sites of intense conflict and deliberate demographic change policies like Arabization. And proximity to state power meant more direct impact from state policies in general. Looking at data from somewhere like the plains city of Sigalan in Iran, you see a whole mix of socioeconomic outcomes, suggesting factors like education, gender, specific state policies, individual circumstances, are maybe more decisive now than just the mountain plain geography itself.
So what is the biggest differentiator for Kurds today, would you say?
Politically, the most significant factor by far is which nation state they live in and what their status is within that state.
You mean like the KRG in Iraq?
Exactly. The experience of Kurds living in the semi-autonomous Kurdistan region of Iraq, with its own government, parliament, official use of Kurdish language, control over the resources recognized in the Iraqi constitution since 2005, is fundamentally different from the experience of Kurds in Turkey, Iran, or Syria, who face varying degrees of oppression and lack similar political rights.
And the situation in Syria, Rojava.
The emergence of the Autonomous Administration of North and East Syria, or Rojava, represents another distinct reality, a de facto self-governing zone, though its future remains contested. These modern political frameworks, alongside displacement, urbanization, integration into national and global economies, they really layer over and complicate those older mountain plain distinctions.
So while history matters, today's reality is shaped more by borders and politics.
I think that's fair to say. Shared experiences, statelessness, conflict, political mobilization, even fighting common enemies like ISIS, have also forged new connections across old divides. The mountain plain dichotomy is absolutely key to understanding the historical diversity and development of Kurdish society, but it might be less predictive of someone's life chances today than their citizenship, whether they live in an autonomous region, whether they're in a city or village, their level of education, and so on.
So wrapping this up then, it seems clear that the landscape, mountains, and plains deeply shaped traditional Kurdish life.
Immensely. From livelihoods like pastoralism versus settled farming, to the decentralized, often autonomous structures in the mountains versus the greater state interaction in the plains, distinct patterns emerged, but they were always interconnected.
And the mountains especially took on this powerful symbolic role.
Yes, as that ultimate refuge, embodying resilience and the spirit of independence. That symbolism remains incredibly potent, even as the reality of Kurdish life has changed so much.
Because those historical distinctions, while vital for understanding the past, have been hugely impacted by modern borders, displacement, and the hard political realities of the last century.
Absolutely. The Kurdish story today is an incredibly complex one of ongoing adaptation, resilience, the continuing search for self-determination. The echoes of the mountains are still there, but the landscape Kurds navigate now is political and social as much as it is physical.
It leaves you thinking, doesn't it? How do those deep historical roots, shaped by the land itself, continue to influence Kurdish identity and political aspirations today, even in a world that looks so different from that of their ancestors? Something for all of us to consider further.